pocket, said I, and I want to say good-bye to Miss Havisham. I was not expected, for she had left me locked in the yard while she went to ask if I were to be admitted. After a very short delay, she returned and took me up, staring at me all the way. Miss Havisham was taking exercise in the room with the long spread table, leaning on her crutch stick. The room was lighted as of yore, and at the sound of her entrance she stopped and turned. She was then just abreast of the rotted bride-cake.
"I don't go, Sarah," she said. "Well, Pip?"
"I start for London, Miss Havisham, tomorrow." I was exceedingly careful what I said. "And I thought you would kindly not mind my taking leave of you."
"This is a gay figure, Pip," said she, making her crutch-stick play round me, as if she, the fairy godmother who had changed me, were bestowing the finishing gift.
"I have come into such good fortune since I saw you last, Miss Havisham," I murmured. "And I am so grateful for it, Miss Havisham."
"Aye, aye,"
said she, looking at the discomfited and envious Sarah with delight.
"I have seen Mr. Jaggers. I have heard about it, Pip. So, you go tomorrow?"
"Yes, Miss Havisham."
"And you are adopted by a rich person?"
"Yes, Miss Havisham."
"Not named?"
"No, Miss Havisham."
"And Mr. Jaggers is made your guardian?"
"Yes, Miss Havisham." She quite gloated on these questions and answers, so keen was her enjoyment of Sarah Pocket's jealous dismay.
"Well," she went on, "you have a promising career before you. Be good, deserve it, and abide by Mr. Jagger's instructions."
She looked at me, and looked at Sarah, and Sarah's countenance wrung out of her watchful face a cruel smile.
"Good-bye, Pip. Are you ill? Always keep the name of Pip, you know."
"Yes, Miss Havisham."
"Good-bye, Pip."
She stretched out her hand, and I went down on my knee and put it to my lips. I had not considered how I should take leave of her. It came naturally to me at the moment to do this. She looked at Sarah Pocket with triumph in her weird eyes, and so I left my fairy godmother with both her hands on her crutch-stick, standing in the midst of the dimly lighted room beside the rotten bride-cake that was hidden in cobwebs. Sarah Pocket conducted me down as if I were a ghost who must be seen out. She could not get over my appearance. I was in the last degree confounded. I said, "Good-bye, Miss Pocket," but she merely stared and did not seem collected enough to know that I had spoken. Clear of the house, I made the best of my way back to Pumblechook's, took off my new clothes, made them into a bundle, and went back home in my older dress, carrying it, to speak the truth, much more at my ease, too, though I had the bundle to carry. And now those 6 days which were to have run out so slowly had run out fast and were gone, and tomorrow looked me in the face more steadily than I could look at it. As the 6 evenings had dwindled away to 5, to 4, to 3, to 2, I had become more and more appreciative of the society of Joe and Biddy. On this last evening, I dressed myself out in my new clothes for their delight, and sat in my splendour until bedtime. We had a hot supper on the occasion, graced by the inevitable roast fowl, and we had some flip to finish with. We were all very low, and none the higher for pretending to be in spirits. I was to leave our village at 5 in the morning, carrying my little hand portmanteau, and I had told Joe that I wished to walk away all alone. I'm afraid, sore afraid, that this purpose originated in my sense of the contrast there would be between me and Joe if we went to the coach together. I had pretended with myself that there was nothing of this taint in the arrangement, but when I went up to my little room on this last night, I felt compelled to admit that it might be done so, and had an impulse upon me to go down again and entreat Joe to walk with me in the morning. I did not. All night there were coaches in my broken sleep, going to wrong places instead of to London, and having in the traces now dogs, now cats, now pigs, now men, Never horses. Fantastic failures of journeys occupied me until the day dawned and the birds were singing. Then I got up and partly dressed, and sat at the window to take a last look out, and in taking it, fell asleep. Biddy was astir so early to get my breakfast that although I did not sleep at the window an hour, I smelt the smoke of the kitchen fire when I started up with a terrible idea that it must be late in the afternoon. But long after that, and long after I heard the clinking of the teacups and was quite ready, I wanted the resolution to go downstairs. After all, I remained up there, repeatedly unlocking and unstrapping my small portmanteau, and locking and strapping it up again, until Biddy called to me that I was late. It was a hurried breakfast with no taste in it. I got up from the meal, saying with a sort of briskness, as if it had only just occurred to me, "Well, I suppose I must be off." And then I kissed my sister, who was laughing and nodding and shaking in her usual chair, and kissed Biddy, and threw my arms around Joe's neck. Then I took up my little portmanteau and walked out. The last I saw of them was when I presently heard a scuffle behind me, and looking back, saw Joe throwing an old shoe after me, and Biddy throwing another old shoe. I stopped then to wave my hat, and dear old Joe waved his strong right arm above his head, crying huskily, "Hurrah!" And Biddy put her apron to her face. I walked away at a good pace, thinking it easier to go than I had supposed it would be, and reflecting that it would never have done to have an old shoe thrown after the coach in sight of all the High Street. I whistled and made nothing of going, but the village was very peaceful and quiet, and the light mists were solemnly rising as if to show me the world, and I had been so innocent and little there. And all beyond was so unknown and great that in a moment, with a strong heave and sob, I broke into tears. It was by the finger-post at the end of the village, and I laid my hand upon it and said, "Goodbye, oh my dear, dear friend." Heaven knows, we need never be ashamed of our tears, for they are rain upon the blinding dust of earth, overlying our hard hearts. I was better after I had cried than before, more sorry, more aware of my own ingratitude, more gentle. If I had cried before, I should have had Joe with me then. So subdued I was by those tears, and by their breaking out again in the course of the quiet walk, that when I was on the coach, and it was clear of the town, I deliberated with an aching heart whether I would not get down when we changed horses, and walk back, and have another evening at home, and a better parting. We changed, and I had not made up my mind, and still reflected for my comfort that it would be quite practicable to get down and walk back when we changed again, and while I was occupied with those deliberations, I would fancy an exact resemblance to Joe in some man coming along the road towards us, and my heart would beat high, as if he could possibly be there. We changed again and yet again, and it was now too late and too far to go back, and I went on. And the mists had all solemnly risen now, and the world lay spread before me. This is the end of the first stage of Pip's Expectations. Chapter 20. The journey from our town to the metropolis was a journey of about 5 hours. It was a little past midday when the 4-horse stagecoach by which I was a passenger got into the ravel of traffic frayed out about the Cross Keys, Wood Street, Cheapside, London. We Britons had at that time particularly settled that it was treasonable to doubt our having and our being the best of everything. Otherwise, while I was scared by the immensity of London, I think I might have had some faint doubts whether it was not rather ugly, crooked, narrow, and dirty. Mr. Jaggers had duly sent me his address. It was Little Britain, and he had written after it on his card,
Just out of Smithfield and close by the coach office.
Nevertheless, a hackney coachman, who seemed to have as many capes to his greasy greatcoat as he was years old, packed me up in his coach and hemmed me in with a folding and jingling barrier of steps, as if he were going to take me 50 miles. His getting on the box, which I remember to have been decorated with an old weather-stained pea-green hammercloth, moth-eaten into rags, was quite a work of time. It was a wonderful equipage, with 6 great coronets outside and ragged things behind for I don't know how many footmen to hold on by, and a harrow below them to prevent amateur footmen from yielding to the temptation. I had scarcely had time to enjoy the coach, and to think how like a straw yard it was, and yet how like a rag shop, and to wonder why the horses' nosebags were kept inside, when I observed the coachman beginning to get down, as if he were going to stop presently. And stop presently we did, in a gloomy street at certain offices with an open door, whereon was painted Mr. Jaggers.
"How much?" I asked the coachman.
The coachman answered,
"A shilling, unless you wish to make it more."
I naturally said I had no wish to make it more.
"Then it must be a shilling," observed the coachman. "I don't want to get into trouble. I know him."
He darkly closed an eye at Mr. Jaggers' name, and shook his head. When he had got his shilling, and had in course of time completed the ascent to his box, and had got away, which appeared to relieve his mind, I went into the front office, with my little portmanteau in my hand, and asked, "Was Mr. Jaggers at home?"
"He is not," returned the clerk. "He's in court at present. Am I addressing Mr. Pip?"
I signified that he was addressing Mr. Pip.
"Mr. Jaggers left word, would you wait in his room? He couldn't say how long he might be, having a case on, but it stands to reason, his time being valuable, that he won't be longer than he can help."
With those words, the clerk opened a door and ushered me into an inner chamber at the back. Here we found a gentleman with one eye, in a velveteen suit and knee-breeches, who wiped his nose with his sleeve on being interrupted in the perusal of the newspaper.
"Go and wait outside, Mike," said the clerk.
I began to say that I hoped I was not interrupting, when the clerk shoved this gentleman out with as little ceremony as I ever saw used, and tossing his fur cap out after him, left me alone. Mr. Jagger's room was lighted by a skylight only, and was a most dismal place. The skylight, eccentrically patched like a broken head, and the distorted adjoining houses looking as if they had twisted themselves to peep down at me through it. There were not so many papers about as I should have expected to see, and there were some odd objects about that I should not have expected to see, such as an old rusty pistol, a sword and a scabbard, several strange-looking boxes and packages, and 2 dreadful casts on a shelf of faces peculiarly swollen and twitchy about the nose. Mr. Jagger's own high-backed chair was of deadly black horsehair, with rows of brass nails round it, like a coffin, and I fancied I could see how he leaned back in it and bit his forefinger at the clients. The room was but small, and the clients seemed to have had a habit of backing up against the wall especially opposite to Mr. Jagger's chair being greasy with shoulders. I recalled, too, that the one-eyed gentleman had shuffled forth against the wall when I was the innocent cause of his being turned out. I sat down in the clientel chair, placed over against Mr. Jagger's chair, and became fascinated by the dismal atmosphere of the place. I called to mind that the clerk had the same air of knowing something to everybody else's disadvantage as his master had. I wondered how many other clerks there were upstairs, and whether they all claimed to have the same detrimental mastery of their fellow creatures. I wondered what was the history of all the odd litter about the room, and how it came there. I wondered whether the 2 swollen faces were of Mr. Jagger's family, and if he were so unfortunate as to have had a pair of such ill-looking relations, why he stuck them on that dusty perch for the blacks and flies to settle on, instead of giving them a place at home. Of course, I had no experience of a London summer day, and my spirits may have been oppressed by the hot, exhausted air, and by the dust and grit that lay thick on everything. But I sat wondering and waiting in Mr. Jagger's close room, until I really could not bear the 2 casts on the shelf above Mr. Jagger's chair, and got up and went out. And when I told the clerk that I would take a turn in the air while I waited, he advised me to go round the corner, and I should come into Smithfield. So I came into Smithfield, and the shameful place, being all a-smear with filth and fat and blood and foam, seemed to stick to me. So I rubbed it off with all possible speed by turning into a street where I saw the great black dome of St. Paul's bulging at me from behind a grim stone building which a bystander said was Newgate Prison. Following the wall of the jail, I found the roadway covered with straw to deaden the noise of passing vehicles, and from this, and from the quantity of people standing about, smelling strongly of spirits and beer, I inferred that the trials were on. While I looked about me here, an exceedingly dirty and partially drunk minister of justice asked me if I would like to step in and hear a trial or so, informing me that he could give me a front place for half a crown, whence I should command a full view of the Lord Chief Justice in his wig and robes, mentioning that awful personage like waxwork, and presently offering him at the reduced price of 18 pence. As I declined the proposal on the plea of an appointment, he was so good as to take me into a yard and show me where the gallows were kept, and also where people were publicly whipped. And when he showed me the debtor's door, out of which culprits came to be hanged, heightening the interest of that dreadful portal by giving me to understand that 4 of them would come out at the door the day after tomorrow at 8 in the morning to be killed in a row. This was horrible, and gave me a sickening idea of London, the more so as the Lord Chief Justice's proprietor wore, from his hat down to his boots and up again to his pocket handkerchief inclusive, mildewed clothes which had evidently not belonged to him originally, and which I took it into my head he had bought cheap of the executioner. Under these circumstances, I thought myself well rid of him for a shilling. I dropped into the office to ask if Mr. Jaggers had come in yet, and I found he had not, and I strolled out again. This time I made the tour of Little Britain, and turned into Bartholomew Close, and now I became aware that other people were waiting about for Mr. Jaggers as well as I. There were 2 men of secret appearance lounging in Bartholomew Close, and thoughtfully fitting their feet into the cracks of the pavement as they talked together, one of whom said to the other when they first passed me,
"The Jaggers would do it if it was to be done."
There was a knot of 3 men and 2 women standing at a corner, and one of the women was crying on her dirty shawl, and the other comforted her by saying, as she pulled her own shawl over her shoulders,
"Jaggers is for him, Melia, and what more could you have?"
There was a red-eyed little Jew who came into the close while I was loitering there, in company with a second little Jew whom he sent upon an errand, and while the messenger was gone, I remarked this Jew, who was of a highly excitable temperament, performing a jig of anxiety under a lamp-post, and accompanying himself in a kind of frenzy with the words,
"Oh, Jaggeth, 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 all otheth is Caggeth Maggeth, give me Jaggeth."
These testimonies to the popularity of my guardian made a deep impression on me, and I admired and wondered more than ever. At length, as I was looking out at the iron gate of Bartholomew Close into Little Britain, I saw Mr. Jaggers coming across the road towards me. All the others who were waiting saw him at the same time, and there was quite a rush at him, Mr. Jaggers putting a hand on my shoulder and walking me on at his side without saying anything to me, addressed himself to his followers. First, he took the 2 secret men.
"Now, I have nothing to say to you,"
said Mr. Jaggers, throwing his finger at them.
"I want to know no more than I know. As to the result, it's a toss-up. I told you from the first it was a toss-up. Have you paid Wemmick?"
"We made the money up this morning, sir,"
said one of the men submissively, while the other perused Mr. Jaggers' face.
"I don't ask you when you made it up, or where, or whether you made it up at all. Has Wemmick got it?"
"Yes, sir," said both the men together.
"Very well, then you may go. Now I won't have it,"
said Mr. Jagger, waving his hand at them to put them behind him.
"If you say a word to me, I'll throw up the case."
"We thought, Mr. Jaggers—"
one of the men began, pulling off his hat.
"That's what I told you not to do," said Mr. Jaggers. "You thought. I think for you. That's enough for you. If I want you, I know where to find you. I don't want you to find me. Now, I won't have it. I won't hear a word."
The 2 men looked at one another as Mr. Jaggers waved them behind again, and humbly fell back, and were heard no more.
"And now, you,"
said Mr. Jaggers, suddenly stopping and turning on the two women with the shawls from whom the three men had meekly separated.
"Ah, Amelia, is it?"
"Yes, Mr. Jaggers."
"Do you remember," retorted Mr. Jaggers, "that but for me you wouldn't be here and couldn't be here?"
"Oh, yes, sir," exclaimed both women together. "Lord bless you, sir, well we knows that."
"Then why," said Mr. Jaggers, "do you come here?"
"My bill, sir," the crying woman pleaded.
"Now I tell you what," said Mr. Jaggers, "once for all, if you don't know that your bill's in good hands, I know it. And if you'll come here bothering about your bill, I'll make an example of both your bill and you and let them slip through my fingers. Have you paid Wemmick?"
"Oh, yes, sir, every farden."
"Very well. Then you have done all you have got to do. Say another word, one single word, and Wemmick shall give you your money back."
This terrible threat caused the two women to fall off immediately. No one remained now but the excitable Jew, who had already raised the skirts of Mr. Jaggers' coat to his lips several times.
"I don't know this man," said Mr. Jaggers, in the same devastating strain. "What does this fellow want?"
"My fear, Mr. Jaggers, home brother to Haber and Lazarus."
"Who is he?" said Mr. Jaggers. "Let go of my coat."
The suitor, kissing the hem of the garment again before relinquishing it, replied,
"Haber and Lazarus, on suspicion of plate."
"You're too late," said Mr. Jaggers. "I am over the way."
"Holy Father, Mr. Jaggers!"
cried my excitable acquaintance, turning white.
"Don't say you're again Abraham Leverith."
"I am," said Mr. Jaggers. "And there's an end of it. Get out of the way!"
"Mr. Jaggers, of a moment. My home cousin's gone to Mr. Wemmick at this present minute to offer him any terms. Mr. Jaggers, half a quarter of a moment, if you have the condescension to be bought off from the other side at any superior price, money no object, Mr. Jaggers, Mr.—"
My guardian threw his supplicant off with supreme indifference, and left him dancing on the pavement as if it were red hot. Without further interruption, we reached the front office, where we found the clerk and the man in velveteen with the fur cap.
"Here's Mike," said the clerk, getting down from his stool and approaching Mr. Jaggers confidentially.
"Ah!"
said Mr. Jaggers, turning to the man who was pulling a lock of hair in the middle of his forehead, like the bull in Cock Robin pulling at the bell-rope.
"Your man comes on this afternoon. Well?"
"Well, Master Jaggers,"
returned Mike, in the voice of a sufferer from a constitutional cold,
"after a deal of trouble, I found one, sir, as might do."
"What is he prepared to swear?"
"Well, Master Jaggers,"
said Mike, wiping his nose on his fur cap this time,
"in a general way, anything."
Mr. Jaggers suddenly became most irate.
"Now I warned you before,"
said he, throwing his forefinger at the terrified client,
"that if ever you presumed to talk in that way here, I'd make an example of you. You infernal scoundrel! How dare you tell me that?"
The client looked scared, but bewildered too, as if he were unconscious what he'd done.
"Spoony," said the clerk in a low voice, giving him a stir with his elbow. "Soft, Ed, need you say it face to face?"
"Now I ask you, you blundering booby,"
said my guardian very sternly,
"once more and for the last time, what the man you have brought here is prepared to swear?"
Mike looked hard at my guardian, as if he were trying to learn a lesson from his face, and slowly replied,
"Either to character, or to having been in his company and never left him all the night in question."
"Now be careful. In what station of life is this man?"
Mike looked at his cap, and looked at the floor, and looked at the ceiling, and looked at the clerk, and even looked at me, before beginning to reply in a nervous manner,
"We've dressed him up like—"
when my guardian blustered out,
"What? You will you?
Spoony,"
added the clerk again, with another stir. After some helpless casting about, Mike brightened and began to say,
"He's dressed like a respectable pieman, a sort of pastry cook."
"Is he here?"
asked my guardian.
"I left him," said Mike, "a setting on some doorsteps round the corner."
"Take him past that window, and let me see 'em."
The window indicated was the office window. We all three went to it behind the wire blind, and presently saw the client go by in an accidental manner, with a murderous-looking tall individual in a short suit of white linen with a paper cap. This guileless confectioner was not by any means sober, and had a black eye in the green stage of recovery, which was painted over.
"Tell him to take his witness away directly," said my guardian to the clerk, in extreme disgust, "and ask him what he means by bringing such a fellow as that."
My guardian then took me into his own room, and while he lunched, standing from a sandwich box and a pocket flask of sherry, he seemed to bully his very sandwich as he ate it, informed me what arrangements he had made for me. I was to go to Barnard's Inn, to young Mr. Pocket's rooms, where a bed had been set in for my accommodation. I was to remain with young Mr. Pocket until Monday. On Monday, I was to go with him to his father's house on a visit, that I might try how I liked it. Also, I was told what my allowance was to be. It was a very liberal one, and had handed to me from one of my guardian's drawers the cards of certain tradesmen with whom I was to deal for all kinds of clothes and such other things as I could in reason want.
"You will find your credit good, Mr. Pip," said my guardian,
whose flask of sherry smelt like a whole caskful, as he hastily refreshed himself.
"But I shall by this means be able to check your bills, and to pull you up if I find you outrunning the constable. Of course you'll go wrong somehow, but that's no fault of mine."
After I had pondered a little over this encouraging sentiment, I asked Mr. Jaggers if I could send for a coach. He said it was not worthwhile, I was so near my destination. Wemmick should walk round with me if I pleased. I then found that Wemmick was the clerk in the next room. Another clerk was rung down from upstairs to take his place while he was out, and I accompanied him into the street after shaking hands with my guardian. We found a new set of people lingering outside, but Wemmick made a way among them by saying coolly yet decisively,
"I tell you it's no use. He won't have a word to say to one of you."
And we soon got clear of them and went on side by side. Chapter 21. Casting my eyes on Mr. Wemmick as we went along to see what he was like in the light of day, I found him to be a dry man, rather short in stature, with a square wooden face whose expression seemed to have been imperfectly chipped out with a dull-edged chisel. There were some marks in it that might have been dimples, if the material had been softer and the instrument finer, but which, as it was, were only dints. The chisel had made three or four of these attempts at embellishment over his nose, but had given them up without an effort to smooth them off. I judged him to be a bachelor from the frayed condition of his linen, and he appeared to have sustained a good many bereavements, for he wore at least four mourning rings, besides a brooch representing a lady and a weeping willow at a tomb with an urn on it. I noticed, too, that several rings and seals hung at his watch-chain, as if he were quite laden with remembrances of departed friends. He had glittering eyes, small, keen, and black, and thin, wide, mottled lips. He had had them, to the best of my belief, from 40 to 50 years.
"So you were never in London before?" said Mr. Wemmick to me.
"No," said I.
"I was new here once," said Mr. Wemmick. "Rum to think of now."
"You are well acquainted with it now?"
"Why, yes," said Mr. Wemmick. "I know the moves of it."
"Is it a very wicked place?" I asked, more for the sake of saying something than for information.
"You may get cheated, robbed, and murdered in London, but there are plenty of people anywhere who'll do that for you."
"If there's bad blood between you and them," said I, to soften it off a little.
"Oh, I don't know about bad blood," returned Mr. Wemmick. "There's not much bad blood about. They'll do it if there's anything to be got by it."
"Well, that makes it worse."
"You think so?" returned Mr. Wemmick. "Much about the same, I should say."
He wore his hat on the back of his head and looked straight before him, walking in a self-contained way as if there were nothing in the streets to claim his attention. His mouth was such a post-office of a mouth that he had a mechanical appearance of smiling. We had got to the top of Holborn Hill before I knew that it was merely a mechanical appearance, and that he was not smiling at all.
"Do you know where Mr. Matthew Pocket lives?"
I asked Mr. Wemmick.
"Yes," said he, nodding in the direction. "At Hammersmith, west of London."
"Is that far?"
"Well, say 5 miles."
"Do you know him?"
"Why, you are a regular cross-examiner," said Mr. Wemmick, looking at me with an approving air. "Yes, I know him. I know him."
There was an air of toleration or depreciation about his utterance of these words that rather depressed me, and I was still looking sideways at his block of a face in search of any encouraging note to the text, when he said, "Here we were at Barnard's Inn." My depression was not alleviated by the announcement, for I had supposed that establishment to be a hotel kept by Mr. Barnard, to which the Blue Boar in our town was a mere public house, whereas I now found Barnard to be a disembodied spirit or a fiction, and his inn the dingiest collection of shabby buildings ever squeezed together in a rank corner as a club for tomcats. We entered this haven through a wicket gate, and were disgorged by an introductory passage into a melancholy little square that looked to me like a flat burying ground. I thought it had the most dismal trees in it, and the most dismal sparrows, and the most dismal cats, and the most dismal houses, in number half a dozen or so, that I had ever seen. I thought the windows of the sets of chambers into which those houses were divided were in every stage of dilapidated blind and curtain, crippled flower-pot, cracked glass, dusty decay, and miserable makeshift, while "To Let, To Let, To Let" glared at me from empty rooms as if no new wretches ever came there, and the vengeance of the soul of Barnard were being slowly appeased by the gradual suicide of the present occupants and their unholy interment under the gravel. A frowsy morning of soot and smoke attired this forlorn creation of Barnard, and it had strewed ashes on its head, and was undergoing penance and humiliation as a mere dust-hole. Thus far my sense of sight, while dry rot and wet rot and all the silent rots that rot in neglected roof and cellar, rot of rat and mouse and bug and coaching stables near at hand besides, addressed themselves faintly to my sense of smell, and moaned, "Try Barnard's mixture." So imperfect was this realization of the first of my great expectations, that I looked in dismay at Mr. Wemmick.
"Ah," said he, mistaking me, "the retirement reminds you of the country. So it does me."
He led me into a corner and conducted me up a flight of stairs, which appeared to me to be slowly collapsing into sawdust, so that one of these days the upper lodgers would look out of their doors and find themselves without the means of coming down, to a set of chambers on the top floor. "Mr. Pocket, Junior," was painted on the door, and there was a label on the letterbox.
"Return shortly." "He's hardly thought you'd come so soon," Mr. Wemmick explained. "You don't want me any more?"
No, thank you," said I.
"As I keep the cash," Mr. Wemmick observed, "we shall most likely meet pretty often. Good day."
"Good day."
I put out my hand, and Mr. Wemmick at first looked at it as if he thought I wanted something. Then he looked at me, and said, correcting himself,
"To be sure, yes. You're in the habit of shaking hands."
I was rather confused, thinking it must be out of the London fashion, but said yes.
"I have got so out of it," said Mr. Wemmick, "except at last. Very glad, I'm sure, to make your acquaintance. Good day."
When we had shaken hands and he was gone, I opened the staircase window and had nearly beheaded myself, for the lines had rotted away and it came down like the guillotine. Happily, it was so quick that I had not put my head out. After this escape, I was content to take a foggy view of the inn through the windows encrusting dirt, and to stand dolefully looking out, saying to myself that London was decidedly overrated. Mr. Pocket, Junior's idea of shortly was not mine, for I had nearly maddened myself with looking out for half an hour, and had written my name with my finger several times in the dirt of every pane in the window, before I heard footsteps on the stairs. Gradually there arose before me the hat, head, neckcloth, waistcoat, trousers, boots of a member of society of about my own standing. He had a paper bag under each arm and a pottle of strawberries in one hand, and was out of breath.
"Mr. Pip,"
said he.
"Mr. Pocket," said I.
"Dear me," he exclaimed. "I am extremely sorry, but I knew there was a coach from your part of the country at midday, and I thought you would come by that one. The fact is, I've been out on your account, not that that is any excuse, for I thought, coming from the country, you might like a little fruit after dinner, and I went to Covent Garden Market to get it good."
For a reason that I had, I felt as if my eyes would start out of my head. I acknowledged his attention incoherently, and began to think this was a dream.
"Dear me," said Mr. Pocket, Jr., "this door sticks so."
As he was fast making jam of his fruit by wrestling with the door while the paper bags were under his arms, I begged him to allow me to hold them. He relinquished them with an agreeable smile, and combated with the door as if it were a wild beast. It yielded so suddenly at last that he staggered back upon me, and I staggered back upon the opposite door, and we both laughed. But still I felt as if my eyes must start out of my head, and as if this must be a dream.
"Pray, come in," said Mr. Pocket, Jr. "Allow me to lead the way. I'm rather bare here, but I hope you'll be able to make out tolerably well till Monday. My father thought you would get on more agreeably through tomorrow with me than with him, and might like to take a walk about London. I am sure I shall be very happy to show London to you. As to our table, you won't find that bad, I hope, for it will be supplied from our coffee-house here. And it's only right, I should add, at your expense, such being Mr. Jagger's directions. As to our lodging, it's not by any means splendid, because I have my own bread to earn, and my father hasn't anything to give me, and I shouldn't be willing to take it if he had. This is our sitting-room, just such chairs and tables and carpet and so forth, you see, as they could spare from home. You must give me credit for the tablecloth and spoons and casters, because they come to you from the coffee-house. This is my little bedroom, rather musty, but Barnard's is musty. This is your bedroom. The furniture's hired for the occasion, but I trust it will answer the purpose. If you should want anything, I'll go and fetch it. The chambers are retired, and we shall be alone together. But we shan't fight, I dare say. Dear me, I beg your pardon. You're holding the fruit all this time. Pray, let me take these bags from you. I'm quite ashamed.
As I stood opposite to Mr. Pocket, Jr., delivering him the bags, one, two, I saw the starting appearance come into his own eyes that I knew to be in mine, and he said, falling back,
"Lord bless me, you're the prowling boy."
"And you," said I, "are the pale young gentleman." Chapter 22 The pale young gentleman and I stood contemplating one another in Barnard's Inn until we both burst out laughing.
"The idea it's being you," said he.
"The idea of it's being you," said I. And then we contemplated one another afresh and laughed again.
"Well,"
said the pale young gentleman, reaching out his hand good-humouredly, "it's all over now, I hope, and it will be magnanimous in you if you'll forgive me for having knocked you about so." I derived from this speech that Mr. Herbert Pocket, for Herbert was the pale young gentleman's name, still rather confounded his intention with his execution. But I made a modest reply, and we shook hands warmly.
"You hadn't come into your good fortune at that time," said Herbert Pocket.
"No," said I.
"No," he acquiesced. "I heard it happen very lately. I was rather on the lookout for good fortune then."
"Indeed?"
"Yes, Miss Havisham had sent for me, to see if she could take a fancy to me. But she couldn't. At all events, she didn't."
I thought it polite to remark that I was surprised to hear that.
"Bad taste," said Herbert, laughing. "But a fact. Yes, she had sent for me on a trial visit, and if I had come out of it successfully, I suppose I should have been provided for. Perhaps I should have been what you may call it to Estella."
"What's that?" I asked with sudden gravity.
He was arranging his fruit in plates while we talked, which divided his attention, and was the cause of his having made this lapse of a word.
"Affianced,"
he explained, still busy with the fruit.
"Betrothed, engaged. What's his name? Any word of that sort."
"How did you bear your disappointment?" I asked.
"Pooh," said he. "I didn't care much for it.
She's a Tartar. Miss Havisham. Oh, I don't say no to that, but I meant Estella. That girl's hard and haughty and capricious to the last degree, and has been brought up by Miss Havisham to wreak revenge on all the male sex. What relation is she to Miss Havisham? None, said he. Only adopted. Why should she wreak revenge on all the male sex? What revenge? Lord, Mr. Pip, said he, don't you know? No, said I. Dear me, it's quite a story, and she'll be saved till dinner time. And now, let me take the liberty of asking you a question. How did you come there that day? I told him, and he was attentive until I'd finished, and then burst out laughing again, and asked me if I was sore afterwards. I didn't ask him if he was, for my conviction on that point was perfectly established. Mr. Jaggers is your guardian, I understand, he went on. Yes. You know he's Miss Havisham's man of business and solicitor, and has her confidence when nobody else has. This was bringing me, I felt, towards dangerous ground. I answered with a constraint I made no attempt to disguise, that I had seen Mr. Jaggers in Miss Havisham's house on the very day of our combat, but never at any other time, and that I believed he had no recollection of having ever seen me there. He was so obliging as to suggest my father for your tutor, and he called on my father to propose it. Of course, he knew about my father from his connection with Miss Havisham. My father is Miss Havisham's cousin. Not that that implies familiar intercourse between them, for he is a bad courtier and will not propitiate her. Herbert Pocket had a frank and easy way with him that was very taking. I have never seen anyone then, and I have never seen anyone since, who more strongly expressed to me in every look and tone a natural incapacity to do anything secret and mean. There was something wonderfully hopeful about his general air, and something that at the same time whispered to me that he would never be very successful or rich. I don't know how this was. I became imbued with the notion on that first occasion before we sat down to dinner, but I cannot define by what means. He was still a pale young gentleman, and had a certain conquered languor about him in the midst of his spirits and briskness that did not seem indicative of natural strength. He had not a handsome face, but it was better than handsome, being extremely amiable and cheerful. His figure was a little ungainly, as in the days when my knuckles had taken such liberties with it, but it looked as if it would always be light and young. Whether Mr. Trabb's local work would have sat more gracefully on him than on me may be a question, but I'm conscious that he carried off his rather old clothes much better than I carried off my new suit. As he was so communicative, I felt that reserve on my part would be a bad return, unsuited to our years. I therefore told him my small story, and laid stress on my being forbidden to inquire who my benefactor was. I further mentioned that as I had been brought up a blacksmith in a country place and knew very little of the ways of politeness, I would take it as a great kindness in him if he would give me a hint whenever he saw me at a loss or going wrong. "With pleasure," said he. "Though I venture to prophesy that you'll want very few hints, I dare say we shall be often together, and I should like to banish any needless restraint between us. Will you do me the favour to begin at once to call me by my Christian name, Herbert?" I thanked him, and said I would. I informed him in exchange that my Christian name was Philip. "I don't take to Philip," said he, smiling, "for it sounds like a moral boy out of the spelling-book, who was so lazy that he fell into a pond, or so fat that he couldn't see out of his eyes, or so avaricious that he locked up his cake till the mice ate it, or so determined to go a bird's nesting that he got himself eaten by bears who lived handy in the neighbourhood. I'll tell you what I should like. We are so harmonious, and you have been a blacksmith. Would you mind it?" "I shouldn't mind anything that you propose," I answered, "but I don't understand you. Would you mind Handel for a familiar name? There's a charming piece of music by Handel called The Harmonious Blacksmith." "I should like it very much." "Then, my dear Handel," said he, turning round as the door opened, "here is the dinner, and I must beg of you to take the top of the table, because the dinner is of your providing." This I would not hear of, so he took the top, and I faced him. It was a nice little dinner. It seemed to me then a very Lord Mayor's feast, and it acquired additional relish from being eaten under those independent circumstances, with no old people by, and with London all around us. This again was heightened by a certain gypsy character that set the banquet off, for while the table was, as Mr. Pumblechook might have said, the lap of luxury, being entirely furnished forth from the coffee-house, the circumjacent region of sitting-room was of a comparatively pastureless and shifty character, imposing on the waiter the wandering habits of putting the covers on the floor, where he fell over them, the melted butter in the armchair, the bread on the bookshelves, the cheese in the coal-scuttle, and the boiled fowl into my bed in the next room, where I found much of its parsley and butter in a state of congelation when I retired for the night. All this made the feast delightful, and when the waiter was not there to watch me, my pleasure was without alloy. We had made some progress into the dinner, when I reminded Herbert of his promise to tell me about Miss Havisham.
"True," he replied. "I'll redeem it at once. Let me introduce the topic, Handel, by mentioning that in London it's not the custom to put the knife in the mouth, for fear of accidents, and that while the fork is reserved for that use, it's not put further in than necessary. It's scarcely worth mentioning, only it's as well to do as other people do. Also, the spoon is not generally used overhand, but under. This has two advantages. You get at your mouth better, which, after all, is the object, and you save a good deal of the attitude of opening oysters on the part of your right elbow." He offered these friendly suggestions in such a lively way that we both laughed, and I scarcely blushed. "Now," he pursued, "concerning Miss Havisham. Miss Havisham, you must know, was a spoilt child. Her mother died when she was a baby, and her father denied her nothing. Her father was a country gentleman down in your part of the world, and was a brewer. I don't know why it should be a crack thing to be a brewer, but it is indisputable that while you cannot possibly be genteel and bake, you may be as genteel as never was and brew. You see it every day." "Yet a gentleman may not keep a public house, may he?" said I. "Oh, not on any account," returned Herbert. "But a public house may keep a gentleman. Well, Miss Havisham was very rich and very proud. So was her daughter." "Miss Havisham was an only child," I hazarded. "Stop a moment, I'm coming to that. No, she was not an only child. She had a half-brother. Her father privately married again. His cook, I rather think." "I thought he was proud," said I. "My good Handel, so he was. He married his second wife privately, because he was proud, and of course in time she died. When she was dead, I apprehend he first told his daughter what he'd done, and then the son became a part of the family, residing in the house you're acquainted with. As the son grew a young man, he turned out riotous, extravagant, undutiful, altogether bad. At last his father disinherited him, but he softened when he was dying, and left him well off, though not nearly so well off as Miss Havisham. Take another glass of wine, and excuse my mentioning that society as a body does not expect one to be so strictly conscientious in emptying one's glass as to turn it bottom upwards with the rim on one's nose." I'd been doing this in an excess of attention to his recital. I thanked him and apologized. He said, "Not at all," and resumed. "Miss Havisham was now an heiress, and you may suppose was looked after as a great match. Her half-brother had now ample means again, but what with debts and what with new madness, wasted them most fearfully again. There were stronger differences between him and her than there had been between him and his father, and it is suspected that he cherished a deep and mortal grudge against her, as having influenced his father's anger. Now I come to the cruel part of the story, merely breaking off, my dear Handel, to remark that a dinner napkin will not go into a tumbler." Why I was trying to pack mine into my tumbler, I am wholly unable to say. I only know that I found myself, with a perseverance worthy of a much better cause, making the most strenuous exertions to compress it within those limits. Again I thanked him and apologized, and again he said in the cheerfulest manner, "Not at all, I'm sure," and resumed. "There appeared upon the scene, say at the races or the public balls or anywhere else you like, a certain man who made love to Miss Havisham. I never saw him, for this happened 25 years ago, before you and I were, Handel. But I've heard my father mention that he was a showy man,
and the kind of man for the purpose, but that he was not to be, without ignorance or prejudice, mistaken for a gentleman, my father most strongly asseverates, because it is a principle of his that no man who was not a true gentleman at heart ever was, since the world began, a true gentleman in manner. He says no varnish can hide the grain of the wood, and that the more varnish you put on, the more the grain will express itself. Well, this man pursued Miss Havisham closely and professed to be devoted to her. I believe she had not shown much susceptibility up to that time, but all the susceptibility she possessed certainly came out then, and she passionately loved him. There's no doubt that she perfectly idolized him. He practiced on her affection in that systematic way that he got great sums of money from her, and he induced her to buy her brother out of a share in the brewery, which had been weakly left him by his father, at an immense price, on the plea that when he was her husband, he must hold and manage it all. Your guardian was not at that time in Miss Havisham's counsels, and she was too haughty and too much in love to be advised by anyone. Her relations were poor and scheming, with the exception of my father. He was poor enough, but not time-serving or jealous. The only independent one among them, he warned her that she was doing too much for this man, and was placing herself too unreservedly in his power. She took the first opportunity of angrily ordering my father out of the house in his presence, and my father has never seen her since. I thought of her having said, "Matthew will come and see me at last when I am laid dead upon that table," and I asked Herbert whether his father was so inveterate against her. "It's not that," said he, but she charged him in the presence of her intended husband with being disappointed in the hope of fawning upon her for his own advancement, and if he were to go to her now, it would look true, even to him, and even to her. To return to the man, and make an end of him, the marriage day was fixed, the wedding dresses were bought, the wedding tour was planned out, the wedding guests were invited. The day came, but not the bridegroom. He wrote her a letter, which she received, I struck in, when she was dressing for her marriage. "At 9:20? "At the hour and minute," said Herbert, nodding, at which she afterwards stopped all the clocks. What was in it, further than that it most heartlessly broke the marriage off, I can't tell you, because I don't know. When she recovered from a bad illness that she had, she laid the whole place waste, as you've seen it, and she has never since looked upon the light of day. "Is that all the story?" I asked, after considering it. "All I know of it, and indeed I only know so much through piecing it out for myself, for my father always avoids it, and even when Miss Havisham invited me to go there, told me no more of it than was absolutely requisite I should understand. But I have forgotten one thing. It has been supposed that the man to whom she gave her misplaced confidence acted throughout in concert with her half-brother, that it was a conspiracy between them, and that they shared the profits. I wonder he didn't marry her and get all the property," said I. "He may have been married already, and her cruel mortification may have been a part of her half-brother's scheme," said Herbert. "Mind, I don't know that." "What became of the two men?" I asked, after again considering the subject. "They fell into deeper shame and degradation, if there can be deeper, and ruin." "Are they alive now?" "I don't know." "You said just now that Estella was not related to Miss Havisham, but adopted. When adopted?" Herbert shrugged his shoulders. "There's always been an Estella since I've heard of a Miss Havisham. I know no more. And now, Handel," said he, finally throwing off the story, as it were, "there is a perfectly open understanding between us. All I know about Miss Havisham, you know." "And all I know," I retorted, "you know." "I fully believe it. So there can be no competition or perplexity between you and me. And as to the condition on which you hold your advancement in life, namely, that you are not to inquire or discuss whom you owe it, you may be very sure that it will never be encroached upon or even approached by me, or by anyone belonging to me." In truth, he said this with so much delicacy that I felt the subject done with, even though I should be under his father's roof for years and years to come. Yet he said it with so much meaning, too, that I felt he as perfectly understood Miss Havisham to be my benefactress as I understood the fact myself. It had not occurred to me before that he had led up to the theme for the purpose of clearing it out of our way. But we were so much the lighter and easier for having broached it, and I now perceived this to be the case. We were very gay and sociable, and I asked him, in the course of conversation, what he was. He replied, "A capitalist, an insurer of ships." I suppose he saw me glancing about the room in search of some tokens of shipping or capital, for he added, "In the city." I had grand ideas of the wealth and importance of insurers of ships in the city, and I began to think with awe of having laid a young insurer on his back, blackened his enterprising eye, and cut his responsible head open. But again there came upon me, for my relief, that odd impression that Herbert Pocket would never be very successful or rich. "I shall not rest satisfied with merely employing my capital in insuring ships. I shall buy up some good life assurance shares, and cut into the direction. I shall also do a little in the mining way. None of these things will interfere with my chartering a few thousand tons on my own account. I think I shall trade," said he, leaning back in his chair, "to the East Indies, for silks, shawls, spices, dyes, drugs, and precious woods. It's an interesting trade."
"And the profits are large?" said I.
"Tremendous," said he. I wavered again, and began to think here were greater expectations than my own. "I think I shall trade also," said he, putting his thumbs in his waistcoat pockets, "to the West Indies, for sugar, tobacco, and rum. Also to Ceylon, especially for elephants' tusks."
"You'll want a good many ships," said I.
"A perfect fleet," said he. Quite overpowered by the magnificence of these transactions, I asked him where the ships he insured mostly traded to at present. "Oh, I haven't begun insuring yet," he replied. "I'm looking about me." Somehow that pursuit seemed more in keeping with Barnard's Inn. I said, in a tone of conviction, "Aha! Yes, I'm in a counting house, and looking about me."
"Is a counting house profitable?" I asked.
"Do you mean to the young fellow who's in it?" he asked in reply. "Yes, to you." "Why, no, not to me." He said this with the air of one carefully reckoning up and striking a balance. "Not directly profitable. That is, it doesn't pay me anything, and I have to keep myself." This certainly had not a profitable appearance, and I shook my head as if it would imply that it would be difficult to lay by much accumulative capital from such a source of income. "But the thing is," said Herbert Pocket, "that you look about you. That's the grand thing. You're in a counting house, you know, and you look about you." It struck me as a singular implication that you couldn't be out of a counting house, you know, and look about you. But I silently deferred to his experience. "Then the time comes," said Herbert, "when you see your opening, and you go in and you swoop upon it, and you make your capital, and then there you are. When you've once made your capital, you have nothing to do but employ it." This was very like his way of conducting that encounter in the garden. Very like. His manner of bearing his poverty, too, exactly corresponded to his manner of bearing that defeat. It seemed to me that he took all blows and buffets now with just the same air as he had taken mine then. It was evident that he had nothing around him but the simplest necessaries, for everything that I remarked upon turned out to have been sent in on my account, from the coffee-house or somewhere else. Yet having already made his fortune in his own mind, he was so unassuming with it that I felt quite grateful to him for not being puffed up. It was a pleasant addition to his naturally pleasant ways, and we got on famously. In the evening we went out for a walk on the streets, and went half-price to the theatre, and next day we went to church at Westminster Abbey, and in the afternoon we walked in the parks, and I wondered who shod all the horses there, and wished Joe did. On a modern computation, it was many months that Sunday since I had left Joe and Biddy. The space interposed between myself and them partook of that expansion, and our marshes were any distance off. That I could have been at our old church in my old church-going clothes on the very last Sunday that ever was seemed a combination of impossibilities, geographical and social, solar and lunar. Yet in the London streets, so crowded with people and so brilliantly lighted in the dusk of evening, there were depressing hints of reproaches for that I had put the poor old kitchen at home so far away. And in the dead of night, the footsteps of some incapable impostor of a porter